rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, a letter to Archibald Stewart in 1791. I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending too much liberty than those attending too small a degree of it. Also coming up on today's program, Congressman Jim McDermott will be here. Some interesting stuff going on up in Washington State and around the country. And that's going to be an interesting conversation, I guarantee it. Right now, David Tebow is with us. He is the editor-in-chief at the conservative Cybercast News Service. CNSnews.com is their website. And David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
You were recently in the hospital.
I was. Well, it's really a situation that started 5 years ago when I had testicular cancer, and then the three drugs used to treat me and radiation, some combination thereof, recently caused leukemia, which is not unheard of in cases like that, but it was about a 1% to 3% chance that I would get leukemia from the treatments 5 years ago, and wouldn't you know it, I fell into the 1% to 3%.
Yeah.
So right now, I'm about to go back into the hospital on Wednesday to get more chemotherapy. This will be my second round. I was in the hospital for about 5 weeks recently.
This is to kill off the now cancerous bone marrow, right?
Which they have gotten rid of all of the leukemia. I am in technically remission right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I am awaiting a bone marrow transplant, and that's kind of the iffy issue, although at this point they have found five preliminary matches on the bone marrow registry program, so I'm really encouraged by
that. That's good news. That's good news. And if people want to learn more about the bone marrow registry transplant program and all that sort of thing, they can just go to tomhartman.com, and right at the top of our little list of you know, hey, here's what's new is a link that goes right to it, as well as to cnsnews.com. And I'm assuming you've got some information over on your website?
You know, I haven't posted anything. I'm not that self-indulgent.
Well, I think you should.
You've been very gracious and indulgent of this, Tom, and I really appreciate it. It's not something that comes naturally to me to throw my own individual case out there.
Well, that's probably true of all of us. If I was going through this, I probably wouldn't be my own website asking for help or assistance, but would appreciate it from others too. I think that's just probably human nature.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, David, what we're going to talk about today is our healthcare system.
Sure.
And you're smack dab in the middle of it. I'm assuming you have health insurance.
I do, thankfully, or I would be broke at this point.
Yeah, so, there's 46 million Americans who don't, and many of them have found themselves in situations not all that dissimilar from yours.
Right.
Why do you oppose national health care?
Well, nobody, first of all, Tom, let me state that nobody in their right mind would want anybody not to have health care insurance. You'd have to be one mean SOB to want to prevent or want to stop health insurance from being applied to everybody. The problem is that when you try to get a big government approach, price fixing, government mandates on the healthcare industry, you reduce incentive for research and development. In my own case, I've been very fortunate. I've been treated at one of the finest hospitals in the world, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. They're not only a treatment hospital, they're a research hospital. And they had me involved in several research projects when I was in the hospital recently. If you impose government mandates and price fixing on an organization like that, you will, by its nature, Tom, reduce the incentive for research, development, advances in medical science.
I don't disagree, and I don't know anybody, at least at the national level with any prominence, who's suggesting those things. So most of the voices that I'm hearing, for example, last week in Seattle, I spoke at a group of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Last year, I was a keynote speaker at the Physicians for National Healthcare annual convention in San Francisco. That was 2 years ago. And everybody that I'm hearing from, particularly the physicians who are advocating for a national healthcare program, are calling for something like what Germany has, which is basically a single-payer system where the government is the insurance company. And, you know, everybody pays into it. There's a shared risk pool, and the government writes the checks for health care. And I mean, we have a situation. This today's Wall Street Journal article by James Bandler and Charles Farrell. United Health Group Chairman and CEO William McGuire is stepping down. This is a guy who last year was paid $1.78 billion.
Right.
This guy is a leech sucking on your and my backs. Why should we have people like this in the middle of our healthcare system as intermediaries between you and me and our physicians, when instead we could have a bureaucrat with green eye shades who's paid, you know, just a basic government salary and is paid to do their job, that which is to make sure that the health care is delivered, rather than paid to make sure that William McGuire can make another $1 billion?
That's obviously an excess, Tom, but wouldn't you agree that the United States has the best medical system in the world?
No. No, I lived in Germany for a year, and I used their medical health care system. We took our kids for routine things. At one point, I thought I might have been having a heart attack. I went into the emergency room. I've seen every dimension of their health care system. It works brilliantly. You show up, you give them your card with your number, and that's it.
I think most people believe that the United States has the best health care system.
I think most Americans believe that, but anybody who's ever been outside this country and used any other health care system doesn't. And if you look at the statistics, David, we don't by any measure. There is no measure. There is no index. Indices?
Uh-huh.
You know, index that shows that, I mean, we rank 23rd in the world in infant mortality. We were 12th in 1960, by the way, when hospitals in all but three states in the United States were required to be nonprofit corporations. Now that they're a for-profit, we're 23rd in infant mortality.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is it that when any foreign dignitary gets sick with a life-threatening disease, they come to the United States for treatment?
Well, it's not true of any foreign dignitary. It's true of generally third-world foreign dignitaries.
It's true of a lot of
the Shah of Iran came here because he didn't want to get assassinated.
I mean, look at the Canadian health care system. You have people crossing the border into the United States to get health care because they're placed on waiting lists.
Actually, that's, you know, by and large, that's only true of plastic surgery, of cosmetic surgery. I lived within an hour of the Canadian border for 10 years in Vermont, and I can tell you every Saturday in Montpelier, there was a busload of people, 20, 30, 40 people, mostly elderly people, who got together to go up to Canada to get health care,
getting drugs.
Get
prescriptions in
That's
Canada.
Right.
But
That's
when
right.
it comes to...
But there were no Canadians coming down and using our health care system. None.
Well, I know of many Canadians who've come to the United States for treatment.
As I said, for discretionary health care. I mean, if you want to get a nose job, or if you want to get... Well, actually, in Canada, you can get it if you just want to pay for it.
No,
the United States ranks
better health care, Tom, you come to the United States. I mean, that's just
David,
the way it is.
David, the fact that Canada's system may not be perfect or might not even be the very best doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to create one here. We rank 20th in life expectancy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We were first in 1945. We were 13th in 1960. Since our system has become for-profit instead of not-for-profit, we're down to 20th in life expectancy. We're 21st in life expectancy.
Remember what our population has done, too. It has become much more stratified. You have, you know, a much larger percentage of people who are poor, a much larger percentage of people who do not practice good health habits. You know, when you have 300
Actually, we have less smoking now, David. I'll go along with you that ever since Reagan declared war on the middle class, that we've got a lot of people who've slid from the middle class into working poor.
You have 300 million people in this country now. I mean, that's what the issue is.
But we're
so
talking
you have a lot more poor people.
I'm talking per capita, not absolute numbers. The United States ranks between 50th and 100th in immunizations, depending on which immunization you want to measure it by. Overall, if you average them all out, we're 67th in the world behind Botswana.
You and I have talked about this issue on several fronts. It comes down to whether you believe free enterprise and capitalism is a better way to go, or whether you believe a socialist system run by the government is a better way to go.
And in that regard, I think that here's the argument that I'd make, David. I want free enterprise and capitalism making my shoes, making my computer, making my house, making my car. I don't want the government mm-hmm. involved in those things. But when it comes to things that have to do with life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the foundational survival stuff, our fire, our police, our educational system, our roads, and frankly, our health care, mm-hmm. I think that there's a role for government to play. I would much rather have a hospital that's interested in knowing whether I'm well than is interested in knowing whether it's profitable.
So it's okay for a shoe manufacturer to grow up and want to make a killing in the market, but it's not okay
sure.
for somebody to want to grow up to be a doctor and make a killing in the market. Is that right?
I would say, it depends on how you define a killing in the market. But, yeah, I would much rather go to a doctor who went into medicine, and that's who I met when I was in Germany. People who, because the doctors there make about $120,000 a year, period. And who went into medicine because they love medicine rather than went into medicine because they thought it was the fastest way to make $2 million. You would disagree?
I guess we're going to commercial.
Yeah.
Well,
you want to stick around and we'll continue the conversation?
I think that...
Just stick around, David. We'll continue this. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with David Tebow.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as the moon. The ruckus in the alley and the summer will be as you. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone and blow. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go.
And welcome back to The Pill. We'll help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with David Tebow of the Conservative Cybercast News Service. Before we get back to that, just a quick note. Friday, October 27th, from 7 to 9 p.m., the University of San Francisco, I, along with Rachel Maddow, Stephanie Miller, and Johnny Steele, local progressive comedian in San Francisco, will be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys, moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown, University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium is put on by our affiliate in San Francisco, the Quake, KQKE, and you can get free tickets in advance by going to quakeradio.com and download the tickets and show up. We need a good cheering section. Wouldn't that be a fine thing? And also a quick thank you to the folks at Book TV, C-SPAN, for running the book signing that I did at Vox Pop in Brooklyn a while back. And if you have a chance to send a quick note to booktv@cspan.org and thank them for showing that, if you saw it, that I'm sure that would be appreciated. David Tebow, Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com. David, here's an example. A dear friend of mine, a guy I've known for years and years, Louis Malmadrona, who wrote several books about medicine, actually, Coyote Medicine, Coyote Healing. He's a Native American, was practicing in the United States and got so fed up because Lewis went into medicine to be a doctor, not to get rich, and Lewis has never gotten rich as a doctor. I mean, he's done okay, but you know, he got so fed up with the fact that he was spending half his time dealing with insurance companies and half his time dealing with drug company hustlers that he moved to Canada to practice medicine. He's now practicing. He's also teaching medicine at the university in I believe it's Calgary or Winnipeg, one or the other, and he's practicing medicine there. In fact, he was just down here a month or two ago, staying at our house over the weekend. And telling us these horror stories about the American healthcare system and the insurance industry. What's wrong with having doctors who go into medicine because they want to be doctors, not because they want to get rich?
Who are altruistic, yeah.
Yeah.
God bless those individuals who are self-sacrificing, Tom, who do want to be altruistic and don't care about...
Well, it's not self-sacrificing to make $125,000 a year.
Well, compared to other individuals in the industry, that represents some form of self-sacrifice. I mean, it represents a willingness not to get very rich, which people in the medical industry have the potential to do.
But see, I don't think they should. I think that the medical industry should be, for the same reason that I don't think that firefighters or policemen should, you know, I think that they're underpaid. But I don't think that we should say, oh, well, police is important, so let's make it possible so that the top cop can make $5 million a year.
Well, it's
Does that make any
nature,
sense?
Tom, for somebody to grow up and want to be a doctor or a lawyer, and the anticipation is that person's going to make a lot of money. I mean, that's been the legacy in this country for a very long time. You know that. I mean, most families...
No, it hasn't been, David.
Most families dream of a child growing up to be either a doctor or a lawyer.
But doctors and lawyers in the United States up until the last 25 or 30 years, by and large, were the upper middle class. They weren't the extremely wealthy.
Well, you have attorneys, trial attorneys, who are more liberal than conservative, who are making a filthy, stinking amount of money.
And they're a small minority of attorneys. But we're not talking about the law right now.
Well, you're talking about
that is a privatized industry.
Capitalism, Tom.
Sure.
And when you talk about the medical industry and you're willing to criticize the medical industry, I mean, where do you want to go next in terms of socializing an industry in the United States? Should we socialize legal practice?
Well, first of all, I'm not calling for socialized medicine. In England, they have socialized medicine where the doctors actually work for the government. I don't think that the doctors should work for the government.
Did you support Clinton Care in the mid-90s when
No.
Hillary Clinton developed
No.
her plan?
No.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
No,
because it was a horribly bureaucratic plan that even Democrats said was crazy.
Yeah, because it kept the health insurance companies intact. I mean, they were trying to you know, make nice with everybody. There's a lot of areas where Bill Clinton and I go in different directions.
Would you have gone farther than where the Clintons went?
Yes, I think that we should go to a single payer system. I think that, and we already have one right now. Medicare is delivering health care in the United States with about a 2.5% overhead. Period. 2.5% overhead. Now, the insurance companies come along and they say, we can deliver medicine for 2% overhead. And they're right. But you know what the average overhead is for health insurance companies in the United States? It ranges from 15.5% to 30%. Now, they're delivering health care for 2%. But the balance of that is going for CEO salaries, stockholder dividends, corporate jets with gold-plated bathrooms, the whole bit. And we don't need all that stuff. Why don't we simply say Medicare for everybody in the United States? Deliver health care for 2%. Everybody can be insured, and it'll actually cost us less than we're paying right now for health care.
We don't need it, but you're dismissing human nature, Tom.
You've got 46 million uninsured people. How can you say we don't need it?
I'm not saying that we don't need to insure the 46 million people. Remember what I said originally. No one in their right mind would want to deny health insurance to any one individual.
Then how are you going to give that health insurance to all Americans?
Look at Massachusetts. Massachusetts has created a nimbler system. It's a state-run system that is including everybody under its health care umbrella.
Right, but they're still using the health insurance companies, and so what they're doing is they're forcing taxpayers to make sure that the health insurance companies are making big dividends and the CEOs are making big salaries.
When you get Washington to dictate across the country, you've got trouble.
You want to continue this conversation with our callers?
Sure.
Okay, stick around. David Tebow is with us, the Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Yes, our phones are working again. 866-440-8466. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
You can cry if you want to. You can rage at the night. You can blame all your wounds on the world if you like. You can drink from the bottle. No ice and no glass. You can lie in the morning and say it's your last, but you won't stop there. No, you won't stop there. You can tell yourself different, but you won't stop there.
And welcome back to Listener Supported Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com, the website. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX, smalldog.com, their website. And the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECOWINE, their telephone number, ecowine.com. We're talking with David Tebow of the Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com, and talking about healthcare in the United States. And David, we've got a whole bunch of callers here on this topic.
Right.
And I'm going to a fairly large extent, just get out of the way and let you talk with these folks.
Sure.
Is that all right with you?
Sure.
Okay. Mike in Ontario, Canada. You're live with David Tebow.
Yeah. I'm listening to this gentleman on the phone here, and I just had to call in. One thing Canadians can't take is when Americans who don't know anything about Canada start talking about what's going on up here. Most of the people who cross the border to get procedures done in America are people who can afford to go to a private clinic. It's mainly MRIs and, like, CAT scans. Because, I mean, in Canada, we only have 30 million people. And if you're not in one of the major cities, CAT scans aren't readily available. So if you don't want to go on the waiting list and wait, you know, how many weeks or whatever to get a CAT scan or MRI done, you can just pay out of pocket and go to Buffalo. But I don't know anybody who would leave a Canadian hospital to go get treatment in America. I mean, that's just not what's going on at all.
Well, MRIs and CAT scans are treatment. I mean, that's the main diagnostic technique.
Yeah, but it's not because they're not available or because the ones we have up here are no good. It's because we have a social system, and unless it's an emergency, you know, you have to go on a waiting list. And if you don't want to wait, we don't have private clinics. We're fighting. As a matter of fact, where they're building a giant hospital not far from where I live in Brampton here. And there's a strong segment of the population that's fighting it because it's going to be the first privatized hospital in one of the first in Ontario. And there was a whole contingent of politicians from England, I think, who privatized their hospitals maybe 15 years back or so, coming to tell us what a horrible idea it is. And to say that our health care is no good and we got to go to America to get health care, it's ridiculous. It's only people who can afford to get private plastic surgery or CAT scans, like not necessary CAT scans, but like say you want to get a checkup immediately and you don't want to wait on a waiting list, you pay and you go to the States. That's
but my understanding, Mike, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mike in Ontario, and this is where...
Yeah, in Toronto.
I'm sorry. My understanding is, and I get this from my friend Lewis, who's practicing medicine up there, is that if I have any indication, let's say that I can, that there's some sense of a tumor or there's some blood test that indicates that I might have cancer or something, and there's any indication whatsoever that I should have a CAT scan tomorrow afternoon, I'll get it tomorrow afternoon.
Certainly. This is only for people who have, like I say, not immediate health risk. They're not at risk.
Well, we've got places like that here in the United States.
You go on to the waiting list. But if you can afford to, because we're fighting private clinics up here too. People like the gentleman on the phone are trying to create a two-tier system in Canada. So where if you can afford to get the best treatment, then you can get the best treatment right away. And everybody else in the social system,
But why shouldn't everybody, Mike, why shouldn't everybody get the best treatment?
Well, we do. But I'm saying that for certain times you have to wait for certain treatments where we don't have 300 million people in Canada. And if you can afford to drive to Buffalo and get a private CAT scan done on your leisure, then that's what you do. Otherwise, if it's not an immediate necessity, then you have to go on the waiting list like everybody else.
Let me interject and say that if I were in Canada and I had to wait to get various scans, I'd be dead now.
Many people are going to die. They're not going to wait and die. We're not talking about people who need immediate care tomorrow to find out life or death.
We're talking about people who have
ailments. And, need certain procedures, and there's a waiting list. Like, we're not a big country.
Now, let me just clarify this, Mike. David, if your doctor had even the faintest inkling that you were developing leukemia, you'd be getting the CAT scan the next day.
Certainly.
Can you guarantee that, Tom?
Certainly, but there are people who do decide.
I'm telling you, that's how it works.
If they're waiting list.
I decide I just want to go get a checkup tomorrow for whatever reason. You can't just go to the hospital and say, I need a CAT scan, give me one tomorrow.
But that's what happens in the United States. When you're sick, if you go into the emergency room, as I did very recently because I had a bacterial infection, I went into the emergency room, and within minutes, they were performing a CAT scan.
How much did you pay for it?
I didn't pay for it because I'm insured.
No, in the United States, I'm going to drop your call. I'm sorry because you're shouting over us. But here in the United States, we're all paying about $11,000 per person per year for it. That's what we're paying for it. In Canada, they're paying about $4,500 per year for it.
And they have waiting lists.
And they have waiting lists for non-emergency procedures. If there's any indication whatsoever that a person is sick and needs immediate care, they get it. I mean, bang, just like that. And similarly, you go to your doctor and say, hey, maybe I should have a colonoscopy or an MRI or whatever, because I'm a certain age or whatever. They say, fine. You call them up and they say, we'll make an appointment 3 weeks from now. That's a waiting list.
It might be 3 months from now.
Well, yeah, it may well be.
It might be 6 months from now.
Well, whatever. It depends on what it is you're trying to get. But, if there's no indication that you're actually sick, if it's just a routine thing, what's wrong with that?
Well, I don't think that I want to be part of a healthcare system that has waiting lists on something like a CAT scan or an MRI.
Well, ideally, I don't think any of us would. And that's why I think that we can do it better than that. Kate in Buffalo, you're live with David Tebow.
Hey, hello.
Kate. Hey, Kate.
Hi, how are you? My comment actually was similar to the last caller's. I live about 10 minutes from the border in Buffalo, and we do get Canadians that come across the border for healthcare treatments. And those treatments are elective treatments. A CAT scan and MRI, for example, I don't know, if I'm out playing baseball and I get, hit in the head with a baseball, in Canada, I'm going to get my CAT scan because it's an emergency procedure. If I just think that, I've had headaches for 3 weeks, they're going to try some other treatments before they give me that CAT scan. And our health care is rationed here just like it's rationed there. I don't see what the difference is.
Well, Kate, what if that headache is a tumor?
Well, I think that you would treat it other ways, I mean, my father...
If the doctor thinks it's a tumor, you'd get the CAT scan.
My father recently had a glioblastoma multiforme. He died from it 5 months after he was diagnosed. But when his first symptoms came in, he went into the hospital, and they thought he had a stroke. And we was being treated for a stroke for about 3 days. And then finally, you know, we went in and we did the MRI, and we found out that he had this hideous brain tumor. Either way, a lot of times you're still waiting, you know, you're waiting for treatment. So I really don't see what this whole argument, you know, this whole argument over, you know, Canadian health care and we have better health care. I mean, how long do you wait for an MRI or a CAT scan in this country when you don't have any money?
Yeah. Well, when you don't have any money, you wait. But yeah, that's a separate problem. I mean,
good point, Kate. Francis in Seattle, you're live with David Tebow.
Yes, I've been a physician since 1983, when I graduated from the University of Iowa, and I did pediatrics first, and then I went into psychiatry. And I am from a lower income family, so I went in to do public health. And
you need to turn off your radio, Francis.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. It's just across the room.
That's okay. we'll hang on for just a second here for Francis because it sounds interesting. Hopefully she'll be right back. There we go.
So I went to medical school to do public health, and I did community mental health until last year when I was unable to continue because I was working so many unpaid hours, I was making myself sick. I mean, literally sick. But I first became aware of the difference between the American and the Canadian system during the time that Hillary Clinton was doing her healthcare initiative. And there, for 3 months, it was such a long series that they published it in over 3 months in Consumer Reports, which is, I think, a fairly unbiased magazine. They described why the outcome rate 5 and 10 years later, after why people were doing better with coronary artery blockage in Canada than in the U.S., despite the fact that they, quote, waited, unquote, for...
That probably has more to do with lifestyle than anything else.
No. Let me tell you the facts. The facts are is that when you go into a Canadian hospital, when you get diagnosed with coronary artery blockage, say 40% blockage of your three of your four main arteries in the U.S., if you have the money, you get surgery. And it is the immediate response of a physician and a patient when they are just together making the decision to want to do as much as possible. In Canada, at the same time, people didn't get immediate surgery, but everyone got treatment for one thing, which 33% of the people in the U.S. don't. But they got medication and intensive counseling to change their diet and exercise. And as later research has shown, you can pull cholesterol out of your coronary arteries. So,
what happened?
By changing your diet.
Changing your diet, yeah.
But what if you've got blockages and you're about to have a heart attack?
No, listen to me. So if that doesn't work, if conservative treatment didn't work, you went to the top of the waiting list for heart surgery. Now, what they did is that 40% of the people that...
Francis, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We have to take a break.
Well, there's serious complications to surgery, including dementia.
Right. Okay. So the bottom line is that the Canadians are doing better as a consequence of that system.
Well, they're not, clearly. And I'll tell you, my best friend is alive today because he had immediate surgery after arterial blockages.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right. And welcome back. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least clean elections, you know, we'd really settle for that. Barbara in Boston, Massachusetts, you are live with David Tebow of the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com.
Oh, yes. Hi, this is Barbara, and I had quite a story to tell about European medicine.
Can you do it very quickly, Barbara?
Sure.
We have a lot of calls, and we're getting way
too long.
I had
an emergency. I took an 18-kilometer drive in an ambulance to a hotel in Florence. Hospital in Florence, where it was I was given the best of triage and sent immediately to the operating room for a checkup. And what they found was that I had gallbladder. I spent the night on observation, and they decided that I could have the operation at home when I came home from there. And I'm a little nervous, but I wanted to tell a story. When I went to pay for all this, the ambulance, the x-rays, the ultrasound, etc., they turned and looked at me and they said, "Madam, you're 72 years old. We in Italy take care of our elderly."
Hmm.
They didn't charge me one penny.
Okay. Barbara, thank you.
Well,
David?
That's a good story, Barbara. And they should have performed the surgery there. You know, you had to come home to get the surgery. And that tells you a lot, I think, about the difference between European healthcare and American healthcare. They thought, in their right mind, that you would be better treated in the United States, and that's why they advised you to get the surgery here.
Maybe they just thought that if you're going to have surgery, you'd rather do it at home.
Well, there's certainly that consideration,
but it depends on
how bad the situation was, right?
Yeah. Well, gallbladder disease is, you know, my wife's mother, grandmother had that for some time. Anyhow, Sandy in Chattanooga, Tennessee, you're live with David Tebow.
Yes, I'm calling about the MRI. They don't do MRIs all the time over here because they're very expensive. They're around $10,000 just for the brain and spine. A few years ago, my son had... Hello, are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're on.
Okay. When my son was four, we were referred to a neurologist, and the neurologist said, no, you don't need an MRI. You need to just get some speech therapy and have some, they thought it was autism. So we took him to more doctors, and they kept saying, no, you need an MRI, you need a genetics test. Well, finally, a year after that point, we had an MRI performed. They called us the next day and told us the results, and he needed brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And the MRI was $9,800. The radiologist read was $1,800. We've spent more on MRIs than we have on brain surgery, hospitalizations, and things. So they just don't do it that often, even if you request it.
Well, they have done it, in my case, not only often, but at their initiative. I mean, I've never had to ask for any of the MRIs or CAT scans that have been done to me. They have said, here's what you need.
Right, because you have insurance. But what about the other 46 million Americans? How, in leaving this to the free market, how are they going to have access to the same kind of health care that you do, David?
Well, I know I trust state initiatives like the one in Massachusetts more than a federal plan devised by Washington bureaucrats and run by Washington bureaucrats as a one-size-fits-all approach that imposes price fixing and other government mandates and reduces incentive for research
and
development.
Again, a single-payer system does not impose price fixing. It allows the government to negotiate for prices. You know, the government is now going and saying to Squibb, you know, we're going to buy 50 million tablets of penicillin this year.
Right.
What's your price on 50 million rather than, you know, right now, what's your price on 5 tablets?
To your point about basically expanding Medicare to involving everyone in the country, Tom.
Right.
How many people are included in Medicare? About 45 million, right?
I don't have the numbers.
I believe it's about 45 million. Well, that's about 15% of the entire population of the United States.
But I would argue that probably represents at least 50% of the risk pool.
That's possible because Medicare is primarily
for the elderly and for the poor.
And otherwise, it's the disabled.
And if we were to insure everybody in the United States, I mean, the math has been done on this, David. If Medicare was available to every citizen in the United States, the average per person cost for health care using the existing health care system, even with the for-profit parts of it, where Bill Frist's daddy gets to be the 20th richest man in America worth $3.5 billion, purely because he sucked all that money out of the healthcare system, it would still only be about $4,500 a person. Right now, we're spending between $10,000 and $11,000.
Do you really believe that you would be able to insure every American?
Yeah. Every other industrialized country in the world has done it. It's not rocket science.
With all due respect, Tom, that's a naive viewpoint because there are people who can't help. There are I don't know what the percentage is, and I don't know how many millions there are, but there are people in this country who you cannot help despite your best efforts. And this is one of the things that liberals just won't understand.
What you're talking about mentally ill people who don't show up in hospitals? Is that what you mean?
No, there are people who just don't. They can't put two and two together, Tom.
So?
I mean, there are people who you will not be able to help no matter what you try.
Well, you know, then with a for-profit system or with a not-for-profit system, with a, Medicare for all or not, it doesn't matter. Those people are going to fall through the cracks. But I'm talking about 46 million Americans.
Well,
and I don't think all of them are.
46 million are people who you just can't help. They're important.
I think it's a very small fraction.
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, okay. And the debate will continue. David Tebow, CNSNews.com. If you want some information on bone marrow transplants, by the way, go to TomHartmann.com. It's at the list of our things there. David, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
Good talking
with
you.
Have a good day.
Good luck in your ongoing hospitalization.
Thanks very much.
Good luck. 56 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back with your calls. And let's see, Congressman Jim McDermott, actually, after the news at the top of the hour, and then we'll be going back to your calls and the news of the day. A lot going on in the world. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Congressman Jim McDermott on the line with us. 6 minutes past the hour. Congressman Jim McDermott, welcome. I'm just great and glad to have you with us. McDermott for FORCongress.com, your main website, but you also have this legal trust, McDermottLegalTrust.org, the website. You're doing a benefit on it's this Sunday, this coming Sunday at 7?
Yeah, it's really quite exciting. It's a picture called Iraq in Fragments, which is a view of a documentary of Iraq of the three segments, the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds. And we're also got a little added thing, which is the camera work that was done by the same guy when I was in Iraq in 2002 and said the president would mislead the country. He was the guy that filmed it. I never knew that, but he's got the film, and he's going to show some of that, too.
Wow, is that James Longley and John Sinnoh?
Yes, John Longley.
John Longley. And, this is incredible. And this is a fundraiser for your legal trust. The tickets are $35 to $100. And why, this is a story that I think is going to boggle the minds of our listeners. Why, Congressman Jim McDermott of Seattle area, more or less Washington State, why do you need the McDermottLegalTrust.org? Why do you need a legal trust?
Well, I was on the ethics committee back in 1996 when we put $300,000 fine on Newt Gingrich, and I, in the process of that, was given a tape which I gave the New York Times of a phone conversation in which he was really undermining the decision by the ethics committee.
He was essentially conspiring to violate the agreement that he had made with the ethics committee that he wouldn't behave unethically any longer.
Exactly. Well, he said he wouldn't even spin the news coverage. That was the thing that he was doing. So he called up his whole leadership and said, "I can't spin it, but no, there's nothing stopping you guys from spinning it." Mm. And was basically subverting the agreement hardly when the ink wasn't even dry. And So they've chased me now in the courts for 10 years. It's cost us somewhere over $400,000 already, and it's going to cost us some more. And we have a court appearance on the 31st of October before the entire Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. We're optimistic, but this has been 10 years in the court. They simply, once they get a hold of your leg, they don't let go.
Well, and isn't the guy who's been primarily chasing you on this, the guy that Wolf Blitzer the other day referred to as John Boehner, John Boehner?
Yes, he's the majority leader, the guy who says he told the speaker everything he knew and walked away. John was sent out to get me in 1996, and he's still trying.
Amazing, amazing. That the guy, you would think that, that people would be above that. I mean, here Newt Gingrich got caught and got caught doing wrong, and because you were part of the process of him getting caught, and didn't you already win this case once?
Oh, yeah, I won it actually twice. I won it in the district court, and it was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, where we won there. But the Court of Appeals, the three judges I've had at this point have not found in my favor. So we now have a opportunity to present the case to the entire court and see if we can't get a different result. And I'm, this is a people's right to know. This is not about Jim McDermott and John Boehner, really. It's whether, if information comes about what's going on in the government, does any citizen, including a congressman, have the right to hand it to the New York Times and say, let the people know?
Right. You're essentially being sued for being a whistleblower.
Yes. That's basically what it is, although I've never been called that, but that's really what it is. It was my giving to the New York Times and saying, you know, I didn't make a press release. I didn't do anything. I just handed the tape to them and said, if you guys think this is important, do with it as you see fit.
And right, and you did not acquire it through any illegal means, although it was initially acquired by a means that was illegal in Florida, listening in on a cell phone conversation, and the couple that acquired it that way actually paid the price for that.
Yes, they did, and I had never seen them. I haven't seen them since. I didn't know anything about them. No one had called me, nothing. A couple walked up to me in the hallway in the Capitol and handed me this tape and said, we think you ought to listen to this.
Yeah,
that's how I got it.
Because you were on the Ethics Committee. We're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State. McDermott is McDermott, two T's at the end. So McDermottLegalTrust.org is what the benefit is going to be for this Sunday. And this is, I think this is a national story. I also want to, you know, because we're on the air in Seattle as well, I also want to, you know, encourage people to show up on Sunday at 7 p.m., October 22nd, and ticket prices are between $35 and $100 because it is a fundraiser. But this is going to be a remarkable film, Iraq in Fragments. What of this film, Iraq in Fragments, Jim McDermott, Congressman McDermott, what is the carry-home message? What's the big lesson
mind? What this is a documentary that has had absolutely wonderful reviews in every major newspaper. They won four awards at Sundance. It is a movie that gives you a view of the Iraqis. You know, in this war, we haven't even been bothering to count the bodies. And this movie actually gives you an in-close, right into the lives of three Iraqis and gives you a feeling for what we are doing and why they hate us. I think there you can't come away from this movie without understanding the anger in Iraq and why our soldiers are having such a tough time and why we're in the middle of a civil war over there.
Yeah. I'm curious, back in 2002, before the election, before the resolution, before the invasion in early 2003, you were saying, you went to Iraq and you came back and said, in fact, I've heard you say it. I was in this church, you and Scott Ritter were speaking, and Paul Loeb, an old friend of mine in Seattle, invited me to come. I was up visiting, and so we went down and heard you talk.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And you were saying, you know, George Bush is going to essentially lie us into this war. I don't think those were the words you used, but that was my carry-home message from it. How did you know?
Well, you know, before I went to Iraq, I talk to a lot of people. I don't just do things half-cocked. I did a lot of research before I went. I talked to the Iraqi ambassador. I talked to Tom Foley, the former speaker. I talked to the foreign minister from Iraq in New York City. I talked to all these people. And the foreign minister told me before I ever left Washington, D.C., he said, you are going to attack us. It doesn't make any difference what we do. You've already decided to attack us. Now, this was in September of 2006. This is six,
of 2002, you mean?
2002, yeah. 6 months before we actually invaded, the foreign minister was saying to me, the decision has already been made. He said, you might as well start the bombing tonight because we know it's going to happen.
Now, that was in September. In January of 2003, Bush was saying...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And he was just not telling the truth.
He simply was not telling the truth, and everybody knew it. And so as I listened the further, you know, we got down the road, it was just clearer and clearer to me that they were going to say lies, really, until we got to the day when they finally changed and said, well, we have to go. And that's really what happened if you look at the history of it. It was terrifying to see it because when I was over there, I could see how much they had suffered under the sanctions. And I could also recognize that they still liked Americans. They really were very positive and warm to me. I had no trouble whatsoever walking the streets without guards or anything else. I was with a bunch of church people from Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I'm looking at McDermott Legal Trust. We only have a minute here before we have to take a break. At McDermottLegalTrust.org, and I don't see a way to show up for this event. How do people register, or how do they get a ticket for this?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One is to go to browntickets.com. That's a website.
Oh, yeah,
brown paper tickets.
Brownpapertickets.com. Yep.
Yeah, and there's an 800 number, 1-800-838-3006. Or they can send money to the McDermott for Congress website, or the Friends of Jim McDermott. Legal Trust Fund is what the one I guess this one's going to. At gmail.com. You can send money through the email. Yeah. That's another way to do it. But we'd like to have them there. They're going to have it's going to be a fascinating movie.
Yeah.
And love to have them there.
Great. Brownpapertickets.com is where you can buy your tickets for the gig Sunday night, the 22nd of October, 7 p.m. It's going to be at the... Where's it going to be here?
It's going to be at the
Moha.
Museum of History and Industry.
Right. There you go. Congressman Jim McDermott, thanks for being with us, sir.
We'll see
you. Indeed, 16 minutes past the hour.
Come to decide that the things that I tried were in my life just to get high on. When I sit alone, come get a little known, but I need more than myself this time. Step from the road to the sea to the sky, and I do believe that we rely on. When I lay it on, come get to play it on, all my life to sacrifice.
And welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America, 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, Link TV will broadcast a four-hour special, Rich and Poor, Inequality in America, on October 28th. What is that? Saturday, October 28th, beginning at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. 4 hours. It's got me in it. It has Robert Greenwald's Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, clips from that, a speech by Bill Moyers. A whole bunch of political satirists, Will Durst. It's a great show, so check it out. LinkTV.com if you want more information. It's going to be this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, in Colorado, conservatives are calling on a strange voice to tell, this is incredible, to tell Coloradans that they should not put they should not pass a ballot initiative that would modify their constitution to change the minimum wage so that it goes up with inflation. You know, using the old canard that minimum wage is going to cause inflation and it's going to cause unemployment and, you know, all these frankly untruths. They've put it into the words of God. Listen to this ad. There's two voices in this ad. One in the actual, it's a TV ad. In the actual TV ad, the God voice, you know, with the echo behind him, is standing there holding the tablets, right? And it's It's kind of like, or I'm sorry, standing up in the heavens, and it's like Moses coming to God and talking to him.
Hello.
Can you hear me now?
We need divine intervention. They want to chisel Amendment 42 into Colorado's Constitution where it doesn't belong.
What on earth are you talking about?
An annual minimum wage increase in stone for eternity.
When inflation and recession come, it'll be a catastrophe.
But it's a plague we'll face every year.
We can't let the people make this mistake. Go, spread the word, vote no on 42.
No, it's not a joke. It's a real ad. God opposes the minimum wage. Well, will they stoop to nothing? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in South Haven, Michigan. Hey, David, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. That's a hard act to follow.
Yeah, follow God. Good luck.
I wanted to make a comment on your previous guest, David Tebow. I tried calling, but I wasn't able to get through when he was on. Listen, that topic strikes real close to home for me because we lost our health insurance about a year and a half ago, just a matter of income not going up fast enough to keep up with the premiums, which for a family now are about $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that said, I was in Canada not long ago, about 8 weeks ago, and I was talking to a couple of people at dinner one night, and I said to them, "Look, what do you think of your healthcare system? How's it work?" And they said nonchalantly, "Yeah, oh, it's fine." And I said, "Well, you know, we hear some things about it. We hear that it's slow, and you have waiting lists, and there are other problems." And they looked at each other quizzically, like they wondered what I was talking about. And I asked, "Isn't that true?" And they said, "No." And they checked with each other. "Have you ever had any problems?" "No." "Have you had any problems?" "No." "So, well, when we needed care, our families needed care, we got it right away." And then one said, "Well, my father had to travel about 100 miles to a hospital that could give him the procedure he needed right away." And I got to thinking, over here on the west side of Michigan, we routinely send people to the Detroit area or Ann Arbor or Chicago. So we travel.
Sure. Sure. It all has to do with being rural. I mean, Canada's by and large a rural nation.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And so I just got to thinking that Mr. Tebow is willing to throw people like myself and family under the bus for whatever kind of ideological purity or whatever it is that he's wanting to defend. But, he's certainly, I just wonder if he could look one of a person in my shoes in the eye and tell me it's okay that you can't have medical care because we're protecting the system.
Well,
anyway,
he's advocating. He's actually saying everybody should have medical care under the system that they put together in Massachusetts, where basically the state pays the health insurance companies. And it's just, my problem with that is that you're still paying the health insurance companies. Why should we pay somebody else to pay the bills for us? Why don't we just pay the bills ourselves?
Yeah, it's, for people who are opposed to bureaucracy, they're institutionalizing a redundant layer of bureaucracy. That
yeah,
makes
exactly.
No sense to me either.
Exactly. It's just it's crazy. I don't get it. But I guess it's the new conservative thing. I got to move along here, David.
Well,
thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks for letting me have my comment.
Sure.
Good enough. Day to you.
Good to hear from you, Lynn in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Lynn.
Ah, tis me. Hi.
Tis you.
Yes, the healthcare issue seems to be a pretty popular one, hot button. I have several points I'd like to make, not least of which is that I am in Massachusetts and...
Oh, Lynn, I'm going to have to ask you to hold on. Hang on just a second.
Push and pull, but they'll never get inside. We've got much to hide.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Announcing the October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members on the message board can vote on the winner, and four runners-up each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. The winner will be announced November 13th. You can get to our message boards by going to tomhartman.com and just click message boards up at the top of the screen. Get your ribbon. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Will in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great program.
Thank you.
Two things I'd like to add to your discussion on the healthcare thing. A non-life-threatening MRI in our area, my wife and I live just north of Seattle, so there's lots of machines in this area. It takes about 3 weeks' time to get an appointment in to get one, and I think any doctor around here would verify that.
Why do we have waiting lists in the United States?
Oh, yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that people talk about the socialized medicine system. I have a lot of relatives in the Vancouver, British Columbia area, and so I'm familiar with their healthcare system and familiar with it down here, too. But anyway, under healthcare or under socialized medicine, you have a lot more people covered or can get help with medical assistance. So therefore, you have a longer wait time just by nature of there's more people can get in.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the arguments that they always make is, well, healthcare is worse underneath that program, but it's not. You just got more people.
Yeah. Good point, Will. Thank you very much. Well made. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to that ad about God disapproving of increasing minimum wage.
Yeah, God doesn't like the minimum wage. I mean, this is crazy. I thought God was in favor of helping the poor.
Yes, I know. And it disturbs me a lot because thanks to conservative Christians, normally God is seen as being on their side and he isn't. And I think anyone who has studied not just the New Testament, the Old Testament, realizes how progressive a book it is.
In many ways, yeah. Occasionally it gets regressive. I mean, the book of Joshua is a little scary, but by and large, yeah.
I'd like to give a couple of examples.
Yeah.
For example, one of the laws given to the Israelites was that loans were to be canceled every 7 years.
Yeah, every seven times 7 years, on every 50th year, the year following the 50th year, all slaves were freed and all debt was, everything was equalized. Everything was divided up equally among all the people. It's called the Jubilee.
Right. Yeah. Yes, if you had to sell your property, the property came back to you or came back to your family.
Right.
Those are just two examples. You were commanded that you could not harvest all of your crops, so you had to leave some for the poor.
Right.
And of course, they were the first ones to institutionalize the 6-day work week, so you always had to
pay off. There you go. And you couldn't charge interest.
Right.
So, yeah. You're absolutely right, Julian. The Bible is a progressive document. Well said. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, you know, we've rarely heard the revealing details behind the ethics violation by Bonner and Speaker Gingrich that came before the Ethics Committee. The media rarely spoke about it, and Ethics Committee member McDermott couldn't for both ethical and legal reasons. But I think it was the Mother Jones that exposed how egregious and how hypocritical the Bonner-Gingrich violation was. The Ethics Committee had just spent 3 years and millions of taxpayer dollars investigating a Gingrich PAC. I think it was laundering money through, I believe it was a blind children's fund, which he had been lying about. Then after finally resolving this, they immediately violated the plea bargain agreement. And when McDermott, you know, took this evidence to the ethics chair, who was also a member of this illicit PAC, she refused to review it. And that's why he gave it to the media, in other words, to the people for a hearing. Yeah. And we never hear about that because, of course, he was under litigation then. He was on the Ethics Committee.
Yeah. Well, we're hearing about it now, and I, you know, better late than never. And, you know, I encourage people to show up and help out Jim McDermott because he's a good guy.
Yeah, he is.
He's,
but
he's one of
not.
The really good guys in the House of Representatives. And this relentless, you know, what, 10-year war now against him, 12-year, however long it's been, and cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you know, and he's having to pay for this out of his pocket. I mean, you know, congressmen don't make, you know, they're not poor, but they don't make huge, you know, bucks. I mean, it's $120,000 a year or something, but it costs a lot to live in Washington, D.C. And it's a tough one. I think people need to be helping him out. Thanks a lot for the call, Dick. I appreciate hearing from you. Tiffany in Sparks, Maryland. Hey, Tiffany, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Tom, I can't sleep at night, and I needed to come on your show and talk to you about this.
Okay.
Well, let's see. For
try melatonin.
Huh?
Try melatonin.
No, this is way more serious than anything like that.
All right.
For the listener's sake, I want to go into a little bit of history, and then I'm going to bring up the current. First of all, have you ever heard of the North American Union or the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America? Because nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, well, we've talked about it several times in this program. Lou Dobbs talks about it a lot.
Yes.
That's about it. But it came out of a meeting in Waco, Texas in 2005 between George Bush, Vicente Fox, and Stephen Harper, as I recall. And basically it's at least economically, at least from the corporate point of view, it's a merging of Mexico, Canada, and the United States. Individuals, people, you and I, will still not be able to easily, we can't just like tomorrow move to Canada and get free health care, for example. But the corporations can act within these three nations as if there were no borders for all practical purposes.
Well, you may be right, and I'll go do some more research, but I had heard that it was going to eliminate our borders. And I've also read that, have you heard anything about the mock parliaments that they're doing? Because they're doing mock parliaments in Canada now using students as a training mechanism to kind of prepare for the debate that would be, you know, incurred in a parliamentary atmosphere as opposed to the non-debate that we have now with a congressional atmosphere. But, you know, I hear that they're doing these mock parliaments now and that they're going to install a parliament which would essentially somewhat negate our constitution and our laws and our government. It would override that. And I may be wrong, but if you could look into
A lot, yeah, I have. There's a lot of fear and loathing around this, Tiffany, and a lot of it is being promoted by a couple of sometimes very right wing guys and sometimes just, you know, kind of general conspiracy guys and you know, one who has developed an entire cult following around himself.
Right. Of course he.
No. Well, no. But the point is that it doesn't mean that they're always wrong. It just means that, you know, the thing is getting hyped. Yes, we should be concerned about this. Yes, it is wrong. But it's part, you have to put it in context. It is the logical extension of NAFTA. I mean,
yes.
It's the logical extension of CAFTA. It's the logical extension of Friedmanism, you know, of world is flatism. And
right.
That is what needs to be attacked. And yes, I agree that that's unconstitutional. It's just wrong. And Tiffany, I'm hearing music in the background.
No, that's my stupid cell phone.
Okay. Well, that's okay. I've got to move along. But, you know, thanks for raising it. I mean, this is an issue that I think does well. You know, we talk about it from time to time. If you really want to, you know, in terms of the economy, go to economyincrisis.org. I mean, you want to see, you know, have we lost the war, as it were? Economyincrisis.org is here's the latest. America defeated in economic war. $2 trillion economic bullets poised to make complete takeover. Japan has accumulated $1 trillion surplus currency reserve in U.S. dollars. China has accumulated $1 trillion. All this monetary ammunition is being used to buy our major corporations, which are for sale daily on the open stock market. We have already lost 8,000 companies in the last 10 years alone to foreign purchase and domination. All this coupled with a dismantled industrial infrastructure assures a foreign domination future and a much lower standard of living. Now, this is not, you know, right or left wing propaganda. This is just, you know, where we're at right now. Because of Reagan and Bush and Bush's starve the beast theory that you throw the government into debt and that's the only way that you can get the American people to go along with doing away with socialism like Social Security. We are, you know, trillions of $8 trillion in debt. Foreign countries are funding almost 100% of our debt, lobbying American politicians, foreign countries. To the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. They're influencing the American media through their advertising dollars. They're influencing American educational institutions through professor fellowship and research funding. They're creating inextricable links to local communities through insourced manufacturing and employment. And we have foreign companies coming in and getting deals. And it's just, this is mind-boggling. Basically, there is, it is the selling off of America, the absolute selling off of America in a very aggressive fashion. And it's the result of these insane trade deals that we have, where we're sending all our dollars abroad to buy goods from overseas and oil, because we don't want to get oil self-sufficient, heaven forbid, energy self-sufficient. And the result is that foreigners are ending up with all these dollars. What are they doing? They're coming back here and they're buying us. They're buying our companies. They're buying our land. They're buying our buildings, the whole thing. Time now for the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question is, in Colorado, conservative ads are claiming that who opposes a minimum wage increase? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. 45 minutes past the hour. Unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour on the Real People's Radio. Tom Hartman radio program. Just a heads up, Friday, October 27th. That would be this Friday, wouldn't it? Yep, this Friday afternoon. No? That's a week from Friday. That's a week from Friday. Okay, thank you. That's so much for my ability to maintain a calendar in my brain. The University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium. I will be debating, along with Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, and Johnny Steele. I'll be debating Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys. The Honorable Willie Brown is going to moderate the discussion. Tickets are free. You can get them over at quakeradio.com. The whole gig sponsored by The Quake in San Francisco, KQKE, which carries this program 3 hours every day, 5 days a week. And congratulations, by the way. We have a winner in our Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question, once again, was, in Colorado, conservative ads are claiming that who opposes a minimum wage increase. And congratulations to Jeff Bell of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. There you go. Jeff knew that the correct answer is God. Oddly and strangely enough. 1-866-440-8466. Lynn in Boston, Mass. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I hope you don't mind getting back to the healthcare issue.
That's fine.
I have a few points. I worked on clinical staff in a major hospital, and can confirm all of the issues raised by other professionals who've called in that, no, it's not as great as people might think, and people do have to wait, and how much money you have in your pocket and how much coverage you get on your policy plays a real big role. As for Mr. Thibault's notion that the wealthy from other countries come here for coverage because it's such a great system, people confuse healthcare quality with the quality of a healthcare system. It is the case that we have really expensive and cutting-edge facilities and treatments and diagnostic approaches, but that's because we spend an exorbitant amount of money on final stage disease rather than total healthcare. And so these people come because they're in dire straits and they want to save their lives. Another point that Mr. Thibault made was that the research, and I don't have numbers on this, but having been involved in medical research before, I can tell you that the likelihood that private investment in research outshines the public investment in research through National Institutes of Health and National Institutes of Mental Health is extremely low.
Well, in fact, are not most drugs, actually the development of most drugs, funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health? or most
more
medical
than
research?
Or health. Yeah, I don't have the numbers on that, but I would
almost all the university research is funded by NIMH.
Yeah, exactly, and I would submit
in NIH.
Yes, I would submit that the research investment within private organizations is very low risk and very highly motivated by profit, which means that we get bazillions of different kinds of drugs for depression that don't really break through in any way.
Right, and each one is just one molecule different from another so that they can patent it.
Yeah, it's you know, how many angels on the head of a pin.
Right.
So there's that point. I don't know what the numbers are. I'm going to try and find them because I'm curious. Two other points that he made that just I nearly fell off my chair. One of them was when he asked the question if we wanted Washington to dictate our healthcare system. Well, excuse me, but as far as I can tell, the profit-making, or if we wanted to go so far as to say the profiteering insurance industry, is dictating our healthcare system.
Right, and try and vote one of those bums out of office.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you made the point that these CEOs are making obscene salaries. It's just, well, anyway. But that brings me to my final point, which is this. Mr. Thibault said, well, what if you want to make a killing being a doctor? And nobody picked up on the irony, the absolutely disgusting irony of his using that terminology. I mean,
yeah.
It's just... Right. There's such a problem with the comfort zone in this country with profiting. And it used to be a dirty word. I mean, you and I are about the same age, and I can remember when the word profit, you didn't brag about profiting. Mm-hmm. It was kind of not such a good thing.
Yeah, and I remember when the hospitals and insurance companies were required to be non-for-profit corporations. And you know, healthcare was pretty good and insurance was pretty cheap.
And
now the Bill Frist's daddy is sucking billions of dollars out of the system. Things sure have changed.
Yeah, and people don't recognize this is a leech-driven system. And, you know, the corporations have managed to make it okay.
Yeah.
They have a right to do this. And that's what, I mean, when he wants to champion a capitalist ideology, somewhere along the line, someone has to remind him that not even Adam Smith allowed for such obscene profiteering. And, in fact, Adam Smith himself emphasized the need for government restrictions on unbridled corporate profits.
Yeah, well said. In Wealth of Nations in 1776. Lynn, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for
your kind
comments. Good talking with you. It is so true. And it's so amazing that there are still conservatives, ideological conservatives, who are arguing, well, you know, 46 million people without health care, maybe they're all just dumb. Maybe they're all just bums. Maybe they just shouldn't get healthy. It's tragic. It's tragic. We're a nation of barn raisers. We're a nation of community. We're a nation of people who work together for the common good. We'll be back with more of your calls and more news right after this. 57 minutes at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance! 6 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Jack in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, Jack, I had a great time Friday night at the South Eugene High School
there.
You were there?
I was there.
That was a hoot.
I called about the healthcare system, but I did want to make one comment in response to something you said Friday night in Eugene. You were decrying the departure of fundamentalist Christianity from anything remotely resembling the New Testament.
Or the teachings of Jesus, anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that maybe we should start reframing and renaming and changing our language the way that conservatives do, and referring to these as neo-Christians, corresponding with neo-conservatives. And,
sure.
Yeah, and I think that would be suitable. Anyway, regarding the world, the healthcare issues, I have some data to add to your arguments.
Okay.
The World Health Organization ranks the United States healthcare system 37th in the world, right between Costa Rica's and Slovenia's.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's our overall system.
That's the overall system. They use five different criteria, which are public health type of criteria.
Right. Okay. Great.
The other interesting data, they've done physician job satisfaction surveys in both Canada and the U.S., and physicians report considerably greater job satisfaction. Canadian physicians do over U.S. physicians, and the same is true with customer satisfaction surveys, where Canadian citizens report greater satisfaction with their system than do U.S. citizens. And, of course, the costs of our system are about twice per capita the cost in all the other developed countries that have single-payer systems.
Right, on a per capita basis.
Yeah.
Jack, where can I find those stats in a nice, tight, easy to repeat way like you just did?
I could send you. I could email you the. I have the World Health Organization has a ranking.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a URL for it?
I don't have it right at hand.
Mm-hmm.
I downloaded it some months ago.
Well, if you
have all 190 countries ranked.
Yeah, if you run across it, would you drop into our chat room and give it to us as a URL, or send it to me, or drop it in our blogs or something? Great.
Yeah, be glad to.
I'd love to have that. I've heard all those in various places and different, discrete.
France and Italy are number one in the world.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, France and even the one you mentioned,
Germany
is down about 18th. So there's many that are even better than that. I know my brother-in-law lives in Germany, and his wife had a heart attack when they were skiing. He lives up in the Bavarian Alps. And my God, the medical care was incredible.
Yeah, it is.
They air-evac'd right off the ski slope to an ER nearby in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, and they did open-heart surgery with her fully conscious.
Whoa. And I'm not sure I'd want that.
Yeah. And she had rehab for 6 weeks at full pay.
Uh-huh.
Up in a beautiful kind of resort-like rehab center up in the Alps, with an entire apartment to herself.
Wow!
And that's at half the cost of the American system.
Yep. Okay, Jack. Thank you very much for the call. And it was also great seeing Nancy there from.
I've been on her show several times.
Yeah, she does a great job.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I got to move along. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Our number. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. A couple things, if I may. I just heard the last part of Mr. Thiebold's interview with you, and I wish him well, by the way.
Me too.
Pardon me?
Me too.
I know you do. So and that's a credit to you. It's a credit to you. However, I strongly resent something that he said, and I don't know exactly what he was mentioning, but I did hear him say the problem with you liberals. And then you were talking about something, and the point you probably remember him saying that the problem with you liberals are.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
that stuff just rolls off me.
Yeah, I am a liberal and I am a progressive, and here's the problem I have with Mr. Thiebold. In all due respect, what you don't understand, Mr. Thiebold, is this, and I hope the Democrats come out strongly in the presidential election. Let alone this one. And that is, we're Americans first. We're Democrats or what have you, but we're Americans first. And on these issues, we have to emphasize we are, I hope I'm not talking too loud, we are Americans first.
That's what you've identified, Gary, is the fundamental cleavage between the conservative worldview and the liberal or progressive worldview.
That's exactly right.
The traditional liberal worldview that this country was founded on, when George Washington said, you know, that he was proud to be a liberal, and Jack Kennedy said he was proud to be a liberal, that traditional liberal worldview is that we are part of a community, the community of a nation, communities, local communities, and a community of a world. And that the goal of governance, the goal of government is to produce life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is to ensure the general welfare, is to provide for the common defense. I mean, it's all about the commons. It's all about we together in this. And the conservative worldview is really pretty much about what can I get for me? Screw everybody else.
That's exactly.
And that's really what it boils down to.
And the second, yes. And the more we emphasize this across America, the better off we will be. The second thing I'd like to mention, and I have mentioned this probably ad nauseum, but I'm going to mention it again. It seems to me that we have deep division right in America. We all know it. And it seems to me, because of this deep division, it clouds the huge difference philosophically between the parties, between the Democratic Party. I'm getting a little sick and tired of people saying, they're all the same, this, that, and everything. No, there's a huge difference, and that difference is this. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said it best, and can I close with it?
Sure.
Government, and this is verbatim, and I learned it here and come from Cleveland, from Walter Mondale, coming back in 1973, to Hyatt the Water. He said, government can err. Presidents may make mistakes. But we are told that the divine justice weighs.
But the immortal Dante tells us
that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted on a different scale. Better the occasional faults of a government living in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government, the Bush government, frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
Yep. Yeah, that's from his 1936 acceptance speech, July 27, 1936 in Philadelphia.
Exactly.
You're welcome, Gary. Thanks for calling in. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Richard in Portland, Oregon, KOPJ, or KPOJ, excuse me. Here I am sitting in the studios of KPOJ.
I know, Tom.
Hey, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I watched you on C-SPAN last night at Vox Pop.
Oh yeah, that was a hoot. That was a hoot. If you like it, drop an email to the C-SPAN folks. I mean, sometimes they replay those things. You know, you can send them an email at booktv@cspan.org.
Yeah, I've taped it for my own use, but yes, I will. Anyway, the reason I'm calling is over the military tribunals.
Yeah.
Bills S-3929 and S-3930 that were passed by the Senate with the help of 12 Democratic votes. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, virtually all of them DLC Democrats.
Exactly. Each one of them was, in fact, a DLC Democrat of the Month at one point or another.
I think all except one or two of them. There were one or two who weren't, but yeah.
Ever since then, I've been going crazy trying to research the case to see whether or not it was constitutional. And
oh,
I know
it's not.
Everybody's concerned about the Habeas Corpus Act.
Yeah, it's not constitutional. You know, Gordon Smith from Oregon got up on the floor of the Senate, and he said, you know, we're just going to have to let the courts sort out whether or not this is constitutional. I mean, the bottom line is these guys know this is not going to pass constitutional muster, but what it's going to do is it's going to buy them 2 years before it gets to the Supreme Court, which will prevent the Democrats from having an actual crime that George Bush committed that they can impeach him for, because it's made what he did a non-crime.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, most people are going on the basis of the habeas corpus aspect of it as being the non-constitutional part. What I got concerned about was that habeas corpus has been sort of a football ever since Abraham Lincoln suspended it during the Civil War, leading to Ex parte Milligan and the Habeas Corpus Act of 1867 and so on. I kept on reading, and I found an interesting thing in Article 1, Section 9, Paragraph 3 of the Constitution, where it says, "No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed."
Right.
The framers were so concerned about that, interestingly enough, this is one of the few things that they also denied to the states.
Right. And we can't, in other words, you can't pass legislation that goes back in the past and says, oh, that is now illegal.
Nor can you pass a bill of attainder, which essentially is meant to punish an individual or a class of individuals, according to the Supreme Court.
No, I got it. Richard, good point. Thank you very much. 16 minutes past the hour.
Heaven and the road only know where
Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Herman Radio Program. By the way, Friday, October 27, 7 to 9 p.m., The Great Debate 2, University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium, Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, Rusty Humphreys on the right. On the left, Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, Johnny Steele, and me, moderated by Willie Brown. You can get tickets if you live in the San Francisco area. This is going to be in San Francisco, University of San Francisco War Memorial Gymnasium. You can get tickets over at quakeradio.com. It's sponsored by The Quake, KQKE, AM 960 in San Francisco, which carries this program. And I'll be there. So be there or be square. It's free, by the way. But you have to get your tickets over at quakeradio.com. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones, our senior Tony Snow fan club correspondent, on the line with us from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Tony Snow fan club, Victoria?
Well, we're all in his fan club today, really, because of the article by Sherry Stolberg in the New York Times about his fundraising trip for Danny Hastert. So we're all sort of honorary members of the Mickey Mouse Club, Tony Snow fan club, really. That's all that's about. But
Are you being ironic or sarcastic?
I am, just a teeny-weeny bit. But it's raised some interesting questions about whether the press secretary should be going on fundraising trips and whether this is ethically the right thing for him to do.
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that his paycheck comes from us, not from the Republican Party, which is also, by the way, true of Karl Rove's paycheck.
Right. Now, Tony Snow takes a personal day on days when he goes to do this, so he is not getting paid.
Oh, he does. Okay.
Right. So, yes, okay. It's the right thing as far as that's concerned. But nevertheless, he's giving, even if he's not giving them red meat speeches, he's not attacking Democrats in the speeches, but nevertheless, he's giving partisan speeches to Republicans that are designed to help them write checks for $100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
and
well,
yet he's supposed to be the spokesperson who speaks for the president to all of America.
And the world.
And the world, yeah.
I mean, this is supposed to be the man who is reflecting the dignity of the office of president of the United States, and instead they've turned him into a sideshow or a carnival shill.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, I suppose. I mean, he certainly is a draw, and it does seem to be working.
Yeah, I think it's just a shame. Anyhow, so what else is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, Secretary of State Rice is getting ready for this trip to Japan, South Korea, and China, where obviously should be talking about the North Korea issue. But
did you notice, pardon my interrupting you, did you notice that a couple of weeks ago when Chris Wallace asked Bill Clinton why he didn't do anything about the coal, the USS Cole, and of course it wasn't until after Bill Clinton left office and the Supreme Court installed George W. Bush as president that the FBI and CIA actually figured out, put it all together, nailed it down, and wrote it up, that the coal was done by Osama bin Laden. So, you know, the real question should have been to Condi Rice as Director of National Security. Why didn't you do anything about Osama bin Laden, the USS Cole, for the first 8 months of the Bush administration? And so anyhow, Chris Wallace said that he had asked Clinton that because he got a lot of emails on the topic. So Think Progress had this thing where, you know, you could email Chris Wallace and ask him to ask the question of Condi because she was on this Sunday. And over 20,000 emails to Chris Wallace asking him to ask Condi Rice why she didn't do anything, why the Bush administration didn't do anything about the USS Cole in their first 9 months in office. And he failed to ask her the question.
I'm shocked and stunned.
Yeah, well, I just thought you'd want to know.
Very interesting, particularly since he did claim that it was emails that caused him to ask President Clinton the question, and I doubt that he got 20,000 emails the first time.
I seriously doubt it, too. What we're getting to is that Fox News has nothing to do with news. Fox News is the media arm of the Republican Party, period.
Well, speaking of which, I can tell you that on the president's schedule today, because, you know, we get read out the schedule in the early morning gaggle, the president had an interview with Bill O'Reilly. Fox News.
Yeah. I'm saddened. I just, you know, what can I say? So Condi Rice is going overseas.
She's going overseas. The other issues really that came up in the briefing today, a little bit about North Korea, but mostly about Iraq. It was not only about this phone call that the president had with Prime Minister Maliki. Prime Minister Maliki is concerned because he's heard rumors that we're giving his government a 2-month deadline and then basically they're out. which is, it turns out, according to Tony Snow, is not true, but also about things, for example, that Senator Chuck Hagel said yesterday in an interview on CNN, and things Senator John Warner's been saying also, all of which are basically saying that we're going to hell in a handbasket fairly quickly. And so he was being asked about those and really put through his paces quite severely by members of the press corps, including Victoria Jones, as a matter of fact.
Well, good on you. Good on you. Well, it's just so clear to me that after the elections, the administration, they have no choice. I mean, you know, you can't win an occupation. It just doesn't, you know, short of absolutely, you know, killing off half the population. I mean, Dresden-style bombing. You can't pacify a population by occupation. It's just never worked.
And there's no signs of it working in this case. No. We're out of time. Yeah.
And all the more is the tragedy. So, anyhow, Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the radio support group, bought by and for we the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. And, in fact, we're going to get to, in just a second, some very specific suggestions about things we can do. But first, let's take a look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones. To fight and to die, and there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wild.
Well, security and other developments in Iraq reported on Monday as of 08:30 GMT by Reuters. Sawaira, at least 10 people were killed and 15 wounded when a car bomb went off near a bank and a market in that town. The mayor said 8 were killed and 48 wounded. Baghdad, 3 roadside bombs exploded, killing 3 civilians and wounding 7 other people, including a policeman. In Baghdad, a total of 46 bodies with gunshot wounds and bearing signs of torture were found since Saturday night. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested 30, quote, terrorists, end quote, and 69 suspected insurgents in different parts of Iraq in the last 24 hours. In Najaf, a roadside bomb targeted the convoy of Mohammed Dika, the head of the police crime department, wounding one of his bodyguards in that Shiite city. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Farouk Atta, an Air Force brigadier, and wounded 2 of his companions on Sunday. In Mosul, gunmen killed the media director of the education department, Ra'ad al-Hayali, on Sunday night in the northern city of Mosul. In other developments, a judge trying Saddam Hussein for the killing of 148 Shiite villagers in the 1980s will set a date on Monday for a verdict in that case that carries the maximum penalty of death by hanging. 53 is the total number of U.S. troop deaths in Iraq this month. At the current rate of American deaths, October is on track, from the New York Times, is on track to be the third deadliest month of the entire Iraq war for American forces. Iraq is 22 times more violent than Washington, D.C. Representative Steve King, the crazed Republican from Iowa, and others have claimed that living in Iraq is less dangerous than living in Washington, D.C. In fact, King claimed on the White House, or on the House floor, House of Representatives floor, quote, "My wife lives here with me, and I can tell you, Mr. Speaker, she's at far greater risk being a civilian in Washington, D.C. than the average civilian in Iraq," end quote. As folks over at thinkprogress.org note, King has always been wrong. A new study by the British medical journal Lancet exposes the extent of his error. According to Lancet, 601,000 people have died in Iraq over the last 3 years due to violence related to the March 2003 invasion. Violent deaths in Iraq, per 100,000 people, 770.5. Violent deaths in Washington, D.C. per 100,000 people, 34. Little bit of a difference there, 770 versus 34. And a new Fox News Opinion Dynamics poll conducted October 10th and 11th finds that nearly 3 in 4 Americans, 73%, believe that U.S. troops should start to come home. Bingo. We have a listener hotline. Our telephone number for, you know, listeners who want to share thoughts but don't want to go on the air live with, you know, some people are shy. They don't mind talking into a phone answering machine, but they don't want to go on the air. So if you'd like to call our comment line, it's 503-323-6620. 503-323-6620. Just remember, your thoughts and opinions may make it on the air, so make it count. And here is one of our callers.
Hey, Tom and company, great job you guys are doing there. I was interested in finding out a little bit more. You mentioned a few days ago that they were not going to be having exit polls this time around, and yet I know your position has been consistently, if we show up in overwhelming numbers, then, you know, they won't be able to get away with, you know, rigging the vote count. What I'm wondering is, if there's no exit polls, how is there going to be any indication of the overwhelming number of people if the polls are Democrat and are showing up for a change? Why couldn't they just say, oh, well, there was a huge voter turnout, but apparently it was, you know, the Republican base wanting to hold on to the majority? I mean, I'm really worried that there'll be no way to show that actually has happened.
Good point. Good point. And in fact, the folks over at Election Defense Alliance, which oddly enough, the URL is electiondefensealliance.org. electiondefensealliance.org, are right now trying to raise money to put together exit polls, independent exit polls. And it seems like a great idea to me, and I encourage you to check it out. Go over to electiondefensealliance.org and you can check it out and see what's going on with that. Here's another one of our callers.
Hi, and all this talk about nuclear reactors and everything, I wasn't sure if you knew that Reed College has its own nuclear reactor here in Portland. Its website is http://reactor.reed.edu, and it's been operating since 1968, and it's operated primarily by undergraduates, about 50 of them, but most people don't know that who live in Portland.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? This is from a listener on KPOJ, which carries this program in the evening. Yeah, I didn't know that Portland had a nuclear reactor operating in the middle of town and or near town. But there are these nuclear reactors all over the United States, most of them run by universities, some of them run by the Department of Defense. And if another country had one of these things, we'd probably go in and bomb them. But we just somehow seem to have a whole bunch of them without any problem. So go figure. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Jude in Seattle. Hey, Jude, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I wanted to go back quickly to the minimum wage. Seattle Times did a piece in the paper, and it said out of the 650 economists, five of them were Nobel Prize winners.
Where you're talking about the 660 economists who just signed the request that the U.S. increase the minimum wage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought that was a very important piece. And the second part, Tom, with your listeners, I mean, there's such an incredibly powerful group of people. I wanted to put out there that we have so much in our intent, you know, for goodness and healing and peace on, you know, really throughout the world. If we could align maybe between 12 and 12:30 every day, there's so many people that believe that they have no power to do anything. But intention, you know, just intention, like critical mass, that I really believe that we could make a change. And even if someone was working or scrubbing floors or raising kids, just to have that 30-minute period.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jude. I am waiting for somebody, maybe the United Church of Christ or, you know, one of the more progressive religious organizations, Tikkun, Rabbi Michael Lerner, somebody to call for a national day of fasting and prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we had October 5th, we had the, drive out the Bush regime day. The world can't wait. And so we've had our let's get out in the streets and be angry day. And I think that's the yin of it. And I think we need the yang of it, really. I think we need the yin of it. We need the balance, the other side of it, which is let's go within. And
but you know, Tom, I don't know if you're a humble soul, but you reach so many people that this in itself could be it. I mean, it doesn't have to be under the name of the church. It could be just under all of us.
Oh, and I don't disagree. But I think that it would be really great if there were a lot of folks who went way beyond, you know, just me and whoever's listening to me. And frankly, you know, calling for a day of fasting and prayer is something I think that I may be wrong. I think it's probably more appropriate coming from a religious organization than coming from a talk show host.
Well, I'm going to still align with you from 12 to 12:30, and I have many, many people. So
okay,
thank
great.
You for everything, Tom.
Thank you, Jude. Nice
Bye.
To hear from you. Patsy in Fir Crest, Washington. Hey, Patsy, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to congratulate you on your new book. I have it, and you made the Pacific Northwest bestseller top 10 list this weekend.
Well, thank you. You're talking about Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class.
Right. It was on, I saw it in the Tacoma News Tribune on Sunday. There you were in the top 10.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's great. Thanks for letting us know, Patsy.
And also, I had all my friends watch you on Sunday on C-SPAN.
Yeah, that was, I recorded it. I saw part of it, but I also lived it.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
You know. A few months ago. And my recollection of it is that Mark Crispin Miller and I had a great time, that there was a good audience and that it was a good rant. So
yeah,
it
was really neat, and I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot, Patsy. Great to hear from you. Eileen in Kensington, Maryland. Hey, Eileen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I saw you also on C-SPAN last night, and you're very impressive. And I have this question that I've been asking my friends, and no one has been able to answer this mm-hmm. for me. And I want to know why the executive branch wants so much power for the executive branch.
Because
if they're going to be in power just for two more years, and they have no apparent Republican heir for the neocons, I don't understand why so much power.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because when you talk to rational Republicans and you say, do you really want the president to have that kind of power if Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president,
exactly.
They blanch.
Exactly.
And
they
so the only...
Nor would they want McCain.
Yeah, so the only answer I can come up with, Eileen, is that they don't expect to give up power. That what we're looking at in some of these folks who are doing this are folks who are essentially fascists. They're hell-bent for leather on a fascistic takeover of America. And that concerns me. It concerns me tremendously.
And so would that explain why they're going to probably go into Iran?
Yes, it would. Because war is a great instrument for that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. 45 minutes past the hour.
They will crush you with wealth and power. Every waking moment you could crack. I'll make the most of one last extra hour. I'll avenge my father's death and I'll step back. Ain't talking, just walking. Hand me down by walking cane.
And welcome back to Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 9 minutes before the hour. And apropos of the last caller, actually, before I get to that, this just a headline here from USA Today. Thanks to Blue in Missouri in the chat room. The Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri, this is from USA Today, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said in an interview with USA Today that his government will not force militias to disarm until later this year or early next year, despite escalating violence in Baghdad fueled by death squads and religious warfare. Not good. Not good. Not good at all. iCasualties.org, by the way. As in Iraq casualties. iCasualties.org, if you want some more information on that. A true tragedy. Anyway, with regard to our last caller, you know, why would the Bush administration and some of the Republicans in power, why would they want to concentrate so much power in the hands of the executive? If you look at the history of the United States, you see that we have a history of flipping back and forth between basically regimes in power. Charles Durber writes about this in a new book that he has out that's actually going to be my BuzzFlash book of the month on Thursday. It'll go up on BuzzFlash.com. You can check it out. And points out that starting from 1865, you know, after the Civil War, I would, you know, frankly, I would chart it from the 1870s. But in any case, he says from 1865 to 1901, we had the first, what he calls the first corporate regime, where corporations rose up and essentially took control of government and certainly took control of the life of the average American. Then after that, you know, then they went away, as it were, and or they were replaced in 1901. The first corporate regime was replaced by the first progressive regime. This was Teddy Roosevelt busting the trusts, changing the nature of things, rolling back corporate power. And that lasted until 1922. And in the middle of that progressive regime, we got to directly elect the Senate in 1913 with the passage of the 17th Amendment. Prior to that, you and I couldn't vote for our senators. They were determined by professional politicians in the states. Women got the right to vote. There were early attempts, some very aggressive, actually, early attempts at strengthening unionization laws. They got knocked down by the Supreme Court, the 1905 Lochner decision, in which the Bread Bakers Union had gotten a law passed in New York that said that if a baker worked more than 40 hours, then he had to be paid time and a half after that. And the bakery, Lochner, sued the state of New York. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yep, you can't have laws like this in a state because it's an unlawful restraint of the right to contract between an individual and a corporation. So there were maximum hour laws. There were minimum wage laws. There were child labor laws. There were protection of union laws. There was an early attempt at a Social Security law. All of these things that were proposed and attempted, and some of them passed during that period from 1901 to 1922. Many of them got knocked down by the Supreme Court, but nonetheless, that was the progressive era. And then from 1923 to 1933, we went back into the second corporate regime, where Warren Harding and Herbert Hoover basically turned America back over to the corporations. The corporations rose up, and you had a second generation or a second group of robber barons rise up and take over America. And then from 1933, with the inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt, until 1980, we had the second progressive regime. This was known as the New Deal. The first one, by the way, was known as the Square Deal. This was the New Deal. And that came to an end in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, which started the third corporate regime, which we're at the tail end of now. In fact, I would argue that the third corporate regime ended in the year 2000 when Al Gore won the election. But because of the theft of the election, because the election was handed to George Bush by the Supreme Court rather than the voters of Florida, who we now know actually in majority voted for Al Gore, because of election theft in the 2000, 2002, and 2004 elections, that third corporate regime is still hanging on. And the question is, when that third corporate regime crumbles, as it is, these regimes always crumble, you know, the progressive and corporate. There's always the pendulum is always going back and forth in this country. As the third corporate regime crumbles, what's going to replace it? And there are really two options, and there are really only two options. Because the corporate regime itself is imploding. And one option is that we slide into fascism. And this was a very real possibility in 1933 as well, that we could slide into fascism. It was very popular in America to call for fascism. And the other possibility is that we could go back to the roots, back to FDR and to Teddy Roosevelt, and reinvent the Square Deal and the New Deal. In other words, go forward into a new progressive regime. And what is going to cause us to make that choice is going to be how many of the people are awakened to the reality of this and how they respond. Because if there is a major terrorist attack, or if there is some rationale for us to flip into fascism, the infrastructure has been put into place over the last 5 years by the Bush administration and the Republicans in Congress. It's there. On the other hand, if enough Americans get active and energized, the infrastructure is also there for us to go back to being a progressive nation. And it's really, ultimately, it all comes down to you and me. Regardless of the outcome of the 2004 election, the 2004 election is just a blip on the screen. This is all stuff that absolutely transcends electoral politics. Anyhow, and the take-home line, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.